The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here with some of the latest stories from our daily news site. First, David, we've got an unusual story comparing civil strife to changes in climate.
Yeah, this is a very controversial study, or bound to be a very controversial study. It basically is stating that the weather can influence how much people fight in various places of the world. And this is a study that is actually built on some other studies. For example, in 2009, researchers showed that spikes in temperature played a dramatic role in African civil wars, and this was also a very controversial study. What's new about this study is that it's a different group, and they're looking at various different climatological phenomena, drought, temperature changes, other things.
This certainly does sound controversial. How did they frame this study?
Well, it wouldn't strike you as a very easy study to do because scientists aren't able to turn the temperature up and down like they would in a normal control experiment and see, you know, if people in hotter temperatures or different types of climates respond differently. What they did instead was they went back to historical record and looked at two types of events, La Nina events, which are basically a cooling of the tropical Pacific, and El Nino events, which warm the Pacific. And these shifts in climate can be pretty rapid. And the researchers wanted to see, you know, after these relatively rapid shifts in climate, was there a change in the conflicts between people in these regions? They were especially looking at equatorial regions because that's really where these events have the most dramatic weather impact. They looked at 234 clashes that cost more than 25 lives each between governments and rebel groups across the globe from about 1950 to 2004. And they found that in tropical nations like Peru, Sudan, and India, the likelihood of civil violence erupting doubled during El Nino years. And again, these are the years where the weather tends to be hotter, where there tends to be more droughts. In fact, the likelihood of conflicts in these areas increased from about 3% to 6% during these El Nino events. That amounted to an extra 48 clashes between different groups of people. And the researchers saw much more dramatic impacts in these regions than in regions that are less affected by El Nino and La Nina, places like the U.S., France, and China. The chances of civil strife remain pretty low regardless of whether there were these rapid changes in climate.
And have these researchers put forth any interpretations of why this might be?
Well, they don't really speculate as to why this may be. They just say, you know, this is a correlation, but it seems to be a very strong correlation, and the data really seem to support it. One idea is that the societies that were most likely to have more conflicts were also those whose nations had economies that were very deeply rooted in agriculture. And you can imagine if there's dramatic weather changes, that's going to have a dramatic impact on agriculture, the economy, and that could make people a lot more nervous, a lot more sort of upset with the government, perhaps, if the government's not doing enough to step in. Of course, this is all speculation.
So how are other researchers responding to this study?
Well, as I alluded to at the beginning, this is controversial, at least bound to be controversial. And some of the same critics that stepped up and criticized the previous study about African civil wars and temperature change are also criticizing this study as just a correlation. Although they are saying it's intriguing, and if it is indeed a true effect, it could actually be really helpful for humanitarian organizations that sort of would like to have a better sense of when they should really sort of beef up their efforts. And if they could tie that to changing climate events, then that could help them out a lot.
And next up is a new spin on the study of religion.
Right. Well, this is actually another correlation. And the correlation here is whether religion influences epidemics and vice versa. The point of evolution, if you can ascribe a point to evolution, is to sort of pass our genes down to the next generation. And if we're going to help people out, especially people that are sick or dying, if we're going to make any preference at all, we should really help the people closest to us because they also share a lot of our genes. And if we help them out, they'll pass their genes down. But this doesn't always happen. Obviously, there's tons of instances in society where people help complete strangers, often at risk to themselves. And this was even more risky activity thousands of years ago when we didn't have modern medicine. And so why were people helping out other people that weren't related to them if, from an evolutionary perspective, it wasn't doing them much good.
And then that's where religion comes in.
Right, exactly. But religion, or a lot of major religions, sort of enforce this idea that we should help others and be kind to others. And so the researchers wanted to see, you know, did religion play a role, especially in early society, in causing people to help others that they might not otherwise help? And these researchers looked back from about 800 BCE to 200 BCE. This is a time where cities were flourishing, but also when deadly plagues were arising that were capable of wiping out vast swaths of people. Also at this time, coincidentally or perhaps not, a lot of modern religions emerged, religions like Christianity, Judaism, Islam. And what these researchers found by studying text and talking to a lot of religious scholars is that the Christian tradition especially sort of enforces this idea of helping others, especially helping strangers. Whereas early Islamic teachings basically disavowed the existence of contagious disease. So Muslims believed at that time that there was really no sense in trying to avoid sick people, and the emphasis was really on caring for one's family. And the Jewish tradition really ascribed death to God's will. And so if somebody was sick, there was really no reason to help them per se, because if God wanted somebody to be sick, they were going to be sick and you shouldn't really interfere. So all this sort of comes together and suggests that religions really played a role in how people treated other people, and especially religions like Christianity could counter these sort of evolutionary ideas about, you know, well, we shouldn't help people that aren't related to us, whereas Christianity and some other religions come in and say, well, you should help those people, and it sort of balances out.
Okay, so that's all about how religions may have affected the propagation of disease, but then how, on the flip side, has disease influenced religion?
Well, it's a good point. And they found that during this time where there was a lot of disease and a lot of societal strife, these were the times when a lot of today's major religions cropped up. The likely reasons for that is when people feel threatened, they tend to form cooperative groups. They tend to try to get together, especially if they're living in cities. Maybe they're far from their families, and so they're trying to find substitutes for families. And religion may have filled this sort of social void that people may have been feeling. And really interestingly, the researchers looked to see if there were any correlations to what they were seeing a couple thousand years ago to today. And they looked at Malawi, which is this African country that has really been slammed by the AIDS epidemic. 1 in 14 people there has AIDS, and it's a leading cause of death there. And what's interesting is that there's a sort of a mix of Christian communities and Muslim communities. And about 30% of the Christians regularly visit the sick, whereas only 7% of the Muslims do. And on the flip side of that, in the areas that were really hard hit, a lot of people were shifting religions, and many of them were moving to the Pentecostal or the African Independent churches, where sick people are more likely to get help from strangers. And especially if you're suffering in one of these countries and maybe you don't have family around to help you, there's a big lure for a religion that's more likely to give you a helping hand.
And our third story today is about the mating habits of bed bugs.
Right. This is a kind of gross story about bed bug sex. And although a lot of us probably don't have a favorable impression of bed bugs, there's actually a lot to pity. For example, they spend most of their life hiding between mattresses and headboards. They only feed once a week. Now, this may not make you feel so bad for bed bugs, but female bed bugs have it even worse. Once they've finished feeding, males attack them, or quote unquote attack them, with bacteria-covered penises. And the reason I say attack is because the male bed bugs are quite likely to not use the proper plumbing and rather just sort of randomly jab her in various places of her abdomen. So it's very unpleasant to be a female bed bug. So the question with this study is, first of all, how do females survive this assault? And also, if the male's penises are covered in bacteria, how do the females protect themselves from getting infected?
Well, that does sound cruel and unusual. Can you give me a bit of a primer on what is already known about bed bug sex and what they were really targeting with this study?
Well, so researchers already knew that the females had evolved a couple adaptations to deal with these very aggressive males. One is a groove in their abdomen that gives the males easier access. But also, this groove, the females actually line this with immune cells. And researchers showed that when males inject their sperm into this cavity, the immune cells sort of work their magic on killing the bacteria. So that's one way the females are protecting themselves. But the researchers were also concerned about timing. And so the question is, How do the females ramp up their immune response when they know the males are coming at them? As I said earlier, the females feed about once a week, and so do the males, and this is usually when they mate with each other. And what the researchers did, which was also kind of cruel and unusual, was they jabbed some female bedbugs with bacteria-laden needles at various times of the week to see if the females would start to sort of develop a response to this, and that wasn't the case. Instead, the females were always ramping up their immune response right after they fed, regardless of when the researchers jabbed them. And so that indicates that this immune response is really tied to the feeding habits of these insects.
So a question that is running through my head throughout this is, why do we care about bedbug sex?
That is a great question. And, well, you could say part of it is just sort of for the gory fascination. But the other reason is, obviously, the immune response is probably protecting these bedbugs from a bunch of other things, and a lot of people want to exterminate bedbugs from their home. So the more we learn about how they regulate their immune response, the more we can actually take advantage of that and have a much more effective way, potentially, of getting these bedbugs out of our beds.
And what other news have we had this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got stories about how our brains record the passage of time. Also a story about a black hole caught in the act of eating a star. For Science Insider, we've got a story about human-elephant conflicts in Sri Lanka and what these have to do with banana plantations there. Also a story about conflicts of interest in biomedical research. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's chat is about the state of women and minorities in science. Why women and minorities are not faring as well as other groups, and what can be done to reverse those trends. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news on the policy blog Science Insider at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.